So we have some new people. So I have to ask before we just dive in, because everybody else here, we're kind of at the fifth class. We're just skating over the top of things, so we've been going through a few things. So I'm just going to have you introduce yourself real quick, and why have you come tonight?
My name is Scott, and I've always been curious about this.
Curiosity's good.
But it's been reading here and there, and just thought I want to
a little bit. Next okay,
level. Exactly, but never actually.
Okay.
You know,
that's all I need. Yeah. I'm just trying to figure out, because sometimes I get students in here, or because we're going to talk about some kind of deep subjects tonight, so I'm just trying to gauge a little bit. And he dragged you, right? Because he wouldn't come alone?
Oh,
okay.
I'm Erica, daughter, and same thing, spiritual exploration.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's always hard to kind of break that ice, but I'm really glad you came, even though it's the fifth. But this is a little bit the deep end. I'll try to make sure that we follow along.
My name is Duran, and
hello.
Just like Scott, I believe his name is.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. I'm here with my girlfriend, and she's been here before, but I have been to a few different sites, Buddhist sites, and never really received any teachings or anything like that, but I've just been an observer, and that's really what I am. I like to see things and get an understanding and see what I can receive from it, whether it be something mental or anything physical, anything like that, because you never know what's available until you really seek it out.
Observing is an excellent word. Okay, welcome.
And, my name is Stephanie, and I was here last year for a class. I had to do a paper on it, and I'm really interested in it, and I want to continue it. Even though it's been a while, I finally have decided this is what I want to get into.
Explore further.
So, yeah,
okay.
For sure.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else brand new tonight? As you see, wow. It's a good thing y'all are here, because I lost a few people already.
Hi, I'm Robert, and I'm interested in spirituality. I've listened to Alan Watts through the years, and I've always had an interest, and finally I came out here
to
see something about it, to learn spirituality. Thank you.
How did y'all find the center? That's the other question I always ask. Facebook, Google, you just Googled it, or did it pop up?
Yeah, Google.
Buddhist centers in Raleigh?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just kidding. I just like to know these things. Marketing is my background. So, same thing?
Yeah, it was a challenge to get here because I think my own marketing kept taking me around and around, and I finally switched to Waze on my phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. That's okay. It's just sometimes it's tough to get here, and then the traffic pattern that they've created for us that's newer doesn't help. Welcome, and welcome back to everybody. This is session 5 of Buddhism in a Nutshell. This is our last evening. It is Tuesday, December 5th, and we have a lot to go through tonight, so I'm just going to kind of jump right into it, and I want to show, usually I start with a meditation. Tonight I'm going to start with a little video that came to my attention again. I've seen it, I saw it many years ago, and then it was actually pulled off of YouTube for proprietary reasons, and I've just recently seen it going around again. And I always thought it was really, really good. And so we're going to start with this video.
There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" The point of the fish story is merely that the most obvious, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see.
This was given at a college grad ceremony.
Of course, this is just a banal platitude. But the fact is that in the day-to-day trenches of adult existence, banal platitudes can have a life or death importance. The plain fact is that you graduating seniors do not yet have any clue what day in, day out really means. There happen to be whole, large parts of adult American life that nobody talks about in commencement speeches. One such part involves boredom, routine, and petty frustration. The parents and older folks here will know all too well what I'm talking about. By way of example, let's say it's an average adult day. You get up in the morning, go to your challenging white-collar college graduate job, and you work hard for 8 or 10 hours, and at the end of the day you're tired and somewhat stressed, and all you want is to go home and have a good supper and maybe unwind for an hour and then hit the sack early, because of course you have to get up the next day and do it all again. But then you remember there's no food at home. You haven't had time to shop this week because of your challenging job. And so now, after work, you have to get in your car and drive to the supermarket. It's the end of a work day, and the traffic is apt to be very bad. So getting to the store takes way longer than it should. And when you finally get there, the supermarket is very crowded, because of course it's the time of day when all the other people with jobs also try to squeeze in some grocery shopping. But you can't just get in and quickly out. You have to wander all over the huge, overlit store's confusing aisles to find the stuff you want. And you have to maneuver your junky cart through all these other tired, hurried people with carts, et cetera, et cetera, cutting stuff out because it's a long ceremony. And eventually, you get all your supper supplies, except now it turns out there aren't enough checkout lanes open, even though it's the end of the day rush. So the checkout line is incredibly long, which is stupid and infuriating, but you can't take your frustration out on the frantic lady working the register, who is overworked at a job whose daily tedium and meaninglessness surpasses the imagination of any of us here at a prestigious college. But anyway, you finally get to the checkout line's front, and you pay for your food, and get told to have a nice day in a voice that is the absolute voice of death. And then you have to take your creepy, flimsy plastic bags of groceries in your cart with the one crazy wheel that pulls Madeline to the left, all the way out through the crowded, bumpy, littery parking lot. And then you have to drive all the way home through slow, heavy, SUV-intensive rush hour traffic, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone here has done this, of course, but it hasn't yet been part of you graduates' actual life routine, day after week, after month, after year. But it will be. And many more dreary, annoying, seemingly meaningless routines besides. But that is not the point. The point is that petty, frustrating crap like this is exactly where the work of choosing is going to come in. Because the traffic jams and crowded aisles and long checkout lines give me time to think. And if I don't make a conscious decision about how to think and what to pay attention to, I'm going to be pissed and miserable every time I have to shop. Because my natural default setting is the certainty that situations like this are really all about me. About my hungriness and my fatigue and my desire to just get home. And it's going to seem, for all the world, like everybody else is just in my way. And who are all these people in my way? And look at how repulsive most of them are, and how stupid and cow-like and dead-eyed and non-human they seem in the checkout line. Or at how annoying and rude it is that people are talking loudly on cell phones in the middle of the line. And look at how deeply, personally unfair this is. If I choose to think this way in the store and on the freeway, fine. Lots of us do. Except thinking this way tends to be so easy and automatic that it doesn't have to be a choice. It is my natural default setting. It's the automatic way that I experience the boring, frustrating, crowded parts of adult life when I'm operating on the automatic, unconscious belief that I am the center of the world and that my immediate needs and feelings are what should determine the world's priorities. The thing is that, of course, there are totally different ways to think about these kinds of situations. In this traffic, all these vehicles stuck and idling in my way, it's not impossible that some of these people in SUVs have been in horrible auto accidents in the past and now find driving so terrifying that their therapist has all but ordered them to get a huge, heavy SUV so they can feel safe enough to drive. Where I can choose to force myself to consider the likelihood that everyone else in the supermarket's checkout line is just as bored and frustrated as I am, and that some of these people probably have much harder, more tedious, or painful lives than I do. Again, please don't think I'm giving you moral advice, or that I'm saying you're supposed to think this way, or that anyone expects you to just automatically do it, because it's hard. It takes will and effort, and if you are like me, someday you won't be able to do it, or you just flat out won't want to. But most days, if you're aware enough to give yourself a choice, you can choose to look differently at this fat, dead-eyed, over-made-up lady who just screamed at her kid in the checkout line. Maybe she's not usually like this. Maybe she's been up three straight nights holding the hand of her husband who's dying of bone cancer. Or maybe this very lady is the low-wage clerk at the motor vehicles department who just yesterday helped your spouse resolve a horrific, infuriating red tape problem through some small act of bureaucratic kindness. Of course, none of this is likely, but it's also not impossible. It just depends what you want to consider. If you're automatically sure that you know what reality is and who and what is really important, if you want to operate under default settings, then you, like me, probably won't consider possibilities that aren't annoying and miserable. But if you really learn how to think, how to pay attention, then you will know you have other options. It will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell-type situation as not only meaningful, but sacred, on fire with the same force that lit the stars. Love, fellowship, the mystical oneness of all things deep down. Not that that mystical stuff's necessarily true. The only thing that's capital T true is that you get to decide how you're going to try to see it. This, I submit, is the freedom of real education, of learning how to be well-adjusted. You get to consciously decide what has meaning and what doesn't. That is real freedom. That is being educated and understanding how to think. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. I know that this stuff probably doesn't sound fun and breezy or grandly inspirational the way a commencement speech is supposed to sound. What it is, as far as I can see, is the capital T truth with a whole lot of rhetorical niceties stripped away. You are, of course, free to think of it whatever you wish. But please don't just dismiss it as some finger-wagging Dr. Laura sermon. None of this stuff is really about morality or religion or dogma or big fancy questions of life after death. The capital T truth is about life before death. It is about the real value of a real education, which has almost nothing to do with knowledge and everything to do with simple awareness. Awareness of what is so real and essential, so hidden in plain sight all around us all the time, that we have to keep reminding ourselves over and over, this is water. This is water.
Yeah, that's it's an old commencement speech, like I said, that was actually pulled down for a long time, so I wasn't able to use it. And you can akin that, you know, while he's giving it a commencement speech, you know, we're talking about the knowledge that we have been sharing of the Buddhist teaching, so it's you can extrapolate the same thing. So it's just something that we're going to kind of wrap our minds around today. So I'm going to start with this one, and you people that are new have to go with it. Last class, they had an assignment, and they had to wake up the next morning, last Wednesday, and they had to think that they had until 5 o'clock, and then they were going to die. So how would you live your life if you were going to die today? And so I'm just curious, did anybody actually do it? Did anybody actually do it? And if you did do it, are you willing to share your thoughts of the day? You don't have to.
Well, I did it Thursday because I forgot to do it on Wednesday. But the interesting thing was I found myself in a conversation with, so I'm a college professor, and so I was talking with one of my colleagues, and we were actually talking about death, and because she had just lost two cousins back to back before Thanksgiving, and we were talking about death, and then I looked at my watch, and it was 5 o'clock, and
yeah.
I realized, oh, I'm supposed to die right now. But the next day I did, and I was very conscious all day. I didn't, I guess that's the one thing was that I can't say that I was necessarily nicer to everybody than I could have been, or that I let everything sort of roll off, you know, like water off a duck's back, but I was way more aware of what was going on moment by moment, which I guess was a good start.
Yeah, that's huge. Like I said, anybody else right behind?
So actually, I did it. When I got up, I thought, yeah, I'm going to die at 5 o'clock. Then I feel everything is more nice, even anything else looks more beautiful than before.
Yeah. That awareness.
Yeah, I feel for me, myself, I have more patience to others and seems more kind to others. But unfortunately, at 5 o'clock, I forgot. Because usually at 5 o'clock, I'm on the bus.
Yeah.
On the bus from Chapel Hill to Ronnie. So I do meditation. Mm-hmm. So I forgot.
But that's part of this exercise, okay? Because it's that, you know, how can we bring that awareness into our everyday life as much as possible? Because we forget all the time. I forget all the time about my teachings and the practice. You know, life gets busy. We get busy with life. That's why they call this a practice. So that's why we actually work on these things. Now, you had your hand up, and then you kept putting it down, and then you put it up, and then you put it down. So I'm going to ask you again. You don't have to, but I'm going to make sure that you have the opportunity if you wanted it.
I think for me it was just more of little things. Like, usually I drive me crazy when people come up and knock on your door and try and sell you things or their religion. So I was walking my dog and these two women came up and, you know, I just told myself to be friendly, take their pamphlet, and, you know, there's no need to be mean or angry. They're just there because, you know, they're supposed to be.
That's the way they feel. Yep.
And I took advantage of things more. Like, there's an ice skating rink that just opened near me, so I was like, hey, you know what? Why not? I'm going to go ice skating.
Because you're going to die.
I know it. Why not?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's an interesting practice. And like I say, it's really a gift. You know, I've... Is he going to? Go.
I have another one.
Okay. I want to hear him. I'll tell you mine. I mean...
I found myself more aware like others and didn't change a ton, but just was nicer and more present, maybe, kind of thing. So,
yeah, and that's actually, you know, the results that we're really. This is all about you and how you feel, and just having again that a little bit more awareness of things, because we tend to get so busy in our lives, and this is water. Okay, I'll keep referring back to that video because it's just like that meditation that we did, Mind Like the Ocean. This is our mind. This is life. And we do have the ability to choose and start to maybe prioritize some things a little bit more and just have that awareness a little bit more. And so that's why that's why they call this a practice. And that's part of the methodology that we're trying to work through with all of this Buddhism. So, okay, we've talked about the history of Buddhism. We've talked about the basic beliefs and concepts the last 4 weeks, and kind of the thought of why are we doing all of this? What is this practice? Why are we doing it? And we've just kind of discovered that here. It's that trying to gain that awareness more every day. And just like, you know, we've talked in this class, the little triggers I have about being in the line, because impatience is that first step on the rung of anger. So it's just like in that video. And if we can't practice with the little things, if we can't practice where we're more patient in that grocery line, where we're more patient on the roads, how do we ever think we're going to handle the big things in life? That's why we use the small things to practice. If we don't practice there, and if we can't master it at a grocery line, how do we ever get the opportunity to really make a difference in our lives when the big things happen? So that's part of this practice and taking it into, the goal that we have. And we are trying to develop the full potential of our minds and the full potential of the human mind to experience true and lasting happiness. I say human, even though we talk about that Buddha nature is in all sentient minds, okay? But the human mind, we have the opportunity to learn. We have had this precious human birth, so we have the opportunity to learn and to work with our minds. And so and what we're trying to do is eliminate the causes of suffering and fully develop our virtuous qualities using that Four Noble Truths. That's that teaching that we've used this entire time to go through these different elements of it. And technically the term for the enlightenment or Buddhahood Some teachers, I know Venerable Rubina, she's a Buddhist teacher that comes here quite often, very straightforward. She's 5 foot nothing and this little powerhouse that will just tell you what for. And she'll cut right through any of the baloney that we all tend to use. And as she'll just say, you don't have to get all holy about this. This is not, we tend to, when we talk about spiritual practice, we tend to put that up here. And that's what we practice when we're sitting on the mat. That's what we practice when we go to church on Sundays. That's what we practice that at specific times. And what Buddhism is about is really trying to bring it into our everyday life, every day. Some days I'm better at it than others. And so it's just trying to work with this every single day. I'll try to pull this stuff up. I'm going to go way past all this stuff because we've already done all this. And everybody's got this down, right? I meant to pull this stuff up. Sure, you got it. No problem. You new people are going, what? Okay, so what is this practical thing? We're talking about the Dharma. Does anybody remember what Dharma meant? And I'm not even on that page. Does anybody remember Dharma? Just shout it out. We're going to start moving. Like I say, we got to get to a big... It can be this... Yep. So it's a Sanskrit word. It means that which holds or protects us from suffering. And one definition is all of the stuff, the Buddhist teachings. And another definition is the, kind of those enlightenments that we have, those aha moments where we get some of this. Okay, so it's a little bit abstract with that. But the realizations in the mind and the experiences in your mind that help you achieve enlightenment, but that's also what we practice in life. So, again, I'm just going to try to... I'm whipping through it. My PowerPoint's going, don't do this. That's where I want to be. Okay. Lama Yeshe, who is the founder of the organization that we belong to, I've talked about this, the FPMT, there's a great quote from him, and he said basically that the Dharma is anything that causes our delusions, our disturbing thoughts, to subside, anything that brings us peace of mind and liberation from confusion and suffering. And it is just as much what we do in our everyday life. This is very practical. This is what I've been saying. This is very practical. This is not some spiritual thing that happens over there. This is the stuff that we do every day. But we don't always get that message. We just don't. But it's just about having a happier and more peaceful life and trying to be of benefit to others, and that's the practice. And we have this practice. I showed you that Lam Rim outline. Okay, we have this all written out. We have the directions. We have the roadmap. And it's just about doing it. Okay, and it should be that easy, right? But it's not. I've been doing this for decades. It is. I wish. Okay, yeah, I wish it were that easy. I wish that my mind could just focus on these things, and I wish I had the power to just, let some of my everyday life in going. But the analogy is that we're working on our minds with our minds. So again, it's like a mechanic racing down the highway at 60 miles an hour trying to work on the car that he's racing. Okay, so that's, we're working on our minds with our minds. And so we have to have a little bit of self-compassion here. So we're doing the best that we can. We don't beat ourselves up. I try not to beat myself up because, I've been practicing a long time and I still muck up with the best of them every day. And it's just that constant reminder of, I can do better. And so that's why we practice. And it's not just, reading about it. It's sitting with it, meditating on it, thinking about it, trying to live it, trying to have that experiential knowledge and not just theoretical knowledge. Because theoretical knowledge is kind of up here and you don't really own it. Once you experience, then you do kind of own it a little bit more, and then you kind of understand it a little bit more, and then you may try to work on it and do it a little bit more. There's another saying, and I think you've already heard me say it, just as a bird needs two wings to fly, so does the bird of enlightenment. The two wings are compassion and wisdom. We've been talking about compassion. Remember the Buddhist definition we talked about, the wish that others not suffer? We take it a step further, even when we talk about bodhicitta. Okay, that's actually number two on the truth of the what's the path. And bodhicitta is the altruistic determination to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings, to relieve their suffering and bring them enlightenment. It's not enough to just for me to become enlightened myself. I want everybody to become enlightened, because my belief is that we can't truly be happy unless everybody else is happy. You know, it's really hard to be sitting in that room and you're, you know, bounding off the walls with joy over something and somebody's over there crying in the corner. I can't do that. But I also have to learn how to swim before I can truly help that person. And so it's part of that taking that responsibility, and it's a very motivating state of mind. And this also brings us to that concept of equanimity. And this is the meditation I want to try to save time for at the end. And we challenge the notion that the way we tend to value other people is based on what they do for us. We view people as friends because of what they do for us. They make us feel good. You know, they do things for us. We can call them. They can help us. We tend to think of friends that way. Enemies, if they offend us, do something to anger, well, they're my enemy. You know, we've got a lot of people that we, you know, really don't, we think of them as more strangers because they haven't done anything for or against us. But it's just really interesting to start deciphering those labels and what they mean. And when we talk about compassion or we talk about bodhicitta, one of the really important aspects of this is to not discriminate against people based on those labels. So we're actually going to do a meditation tonight that's going to help us with equanimity and kind of not discriminating against people just based on our own likes or dislikes. And now it's certainly fair to say that I don't want to be around somebody because of their actions and what they do. I'm not saying you have to go out and hang out with people that do drugs or, you know, are going to go rob you. You know, that's a different, don't take these things to the extremes. But you can certainly have compassion for people. So it's having true compassion for yourself and true compassion for others. And then so tonight we're going to actually move on to the other wing, which is wisdom. And we're going to get very, very specific about this. But first, I do want to go through one quick thing, because, again, I'm just trying to give you awareness of all the things that you're going to come into. When you go on, has anybody been downloading any of the meditations or the sheets from the website? Because they are there, okay? All of the meditations that I've done, all of the different things that I've done, the foundation or the Four Noble Truths and a few other worksheets are up on the website, kadampacenter.org, okay, under spiritual programs. Just go find Buddhism in a Nutshell class, and all these handouts will be there. All of these handouts and all of these meditations will be there. And when you do that, you're going to come up on this one handout number 6 called The Foundation of All Good Qualities. Now, this, if you download this. There's a lot of the Buddhism in a Nutshell teachers, just like I've kind of used the Four Noble Truths as the basics to go through the Buddhist teachings and how they apply to our everyday life, and I've kind of broken this out and used that as kind of my platform. Several of the Buddhism in a Nutshell teachers will use the Foundation of All Good Qualities to do that very same thing. This, too, has the entire Buddhist path in it, okay? And a lot of the things that we've discussed here in this class are in these different stanzas. And so I will just do one for you just to kind of give you an overlook on it. But this is discussed karma, precious human life, samsara. The opening verse, the foundation of all good qualities is the kind and venerable guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. Now, that goes back to, remember I told you that the difference of teachers here in America, that word teacher. So right away, you say the word guru, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, my goodness, who's drinking the Kool-Aid, right? Here in the Western world, people, that word is not necessarily a positive word. Guru and lama kind of mean that same thing, and that the word is heavy, heavy with knowledge, all right? So if we used maybe the word mentor, here's somebody that helps to guide. Even in, I think it's a Japanese proverb, that your parents give you life and teachers help you learn what to do with it. So in Buddhism, and in the especially Tibetan Buddhism, a teacher, you're supposed to take 12 years to look at that teacher, look at all of his qualities. They're very specific on the qualities of these teachers, and you have to decide if he's truly qualified to be your teacher. And there's lists. Again, Tibetan Buddhism, there's like a list of 10 of these qualities. So you can go and you can look at these qualities. You don't just accept somebody. You don't just, you know, see them one time, two times, even for a year. You're supposed to check them out. A teacher means a totally different thing in Tibetan Buddhism, especially, than it does in our Western world. So it's these language differences that we have to be very aware of. And then there's also, guess what? There's a list for students because he may not accept you. It's just like making an application to college. That teacher that you want and you ask, they may turn you down. There's things that we have to do as students to be qualified to be their student. So before you actually just go out and say, you know what, I want him to be my teacher. Let's take Geshe Gelug Choda, who's our resident teacher here, specifically. When he teaches here, like on Sundays and stuff, he doesn't consider himself our teacher. At that point, he considers himself our Dharma friend, because again, he'll think about it so differently. I'm not your teacher sitting up here. I'm not a teacher. I'm your Dharma friend. I'm a class leader. I will not talk about myself as being a teacher, because in this aspect, that's a totally different thing. So again, as we kind of work through some of this stuff, it's making sure that you carefully consider these words and understand what the meaning is there. Just like when I use suffering, from an American standpoint, that word doesn't give us enough information for what the Buddha was talking about here. That's why I use that Sanskrit word dukkha, because it was the three divines, like encompass it. So this language, let's make sure that we always, my recommendation is when you're looking at anything in Buddhism, and you're looking at any of these classes, you're talking to any teacher, you're listening to any recording, don't just take those words that they're saying as these American quick words that we tend to use. Think about the depth of what they might be saying from what the teaching might mean. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
The language is a huge difference. And I pull myself onto this all the time because it helps me just to remember what's going on. So the foundation of all good qualities, you can just go through this as a glance meditation. And it kind of covers this whole thing. And again, it's a beautiful prayer. It's a good one to read. The Four Noble Truths just kind of works for the way I lead this class, but you'll see a lot of teachers work with this. So I just wanted you to be aware of that if people were going on there and downloading that. And again, on that spiritual guide, we have that Discovering Buddhism class I talked about that's 2 years and has 14 different modules. One module is based on the spiritual guide. They'll spend 5-6 weeks on just that subject. So it's that critically important. So, that's the one that's going on right now?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Yes. That's really, it's really important to kind of keep a line on that. Okay. A pause moment. Is there any questions about anything that you have or anything that we've talked about in class right now? Because before we start on the next big concept, I want to make sure that we've got, that I'm clearing up any questions that you might have. Yes, sir. I'm going to have you speak into the mic because we record these, and there's nothing more irritating than we're trying to listen to a recording and you don't hear the questions. Is that anybody else's little mini frustration that you have to work with?
Yeah, actually, this is more of a comment. The 2-year class that
yes.
you were talking about, I'd called today and I spoke with Jill, and I was under the presumption that that's, you know, starts whenever it starts, you have to get in the beginning, and that's not true.
Nope.
So you can come in at any module
yep.
during any month. So
yes.
I just don't know if anybody else was wondering the same,
yeah.
same thing. So.
So that's a good comment. I'll cover that right now, and then at the end of this class, I'm going to talk about different next steps. But that is kind of a misconception that people do have. That Discovering Buddhism class is 2 years in from start to finish. It's 14 different modules that take place over 5-6 weeks of each module. You can come in on module 12. You know, they just prefer that you come in at the first day, the first class. Don't come in at the, you know, class 6 of those, because that really will be the deep end of the pool, and that's a little bit hard. But you can start at any time. And most people, you know, there's very few that actually have the karma to start right at the center. And I was one of them, good karma here. But just step in, because most of the classes, everything that we talk about, there's really, you're going to hear these same things over and over again, but from different ways. And then they start kind of adding to it. So, and anytime you don't understand something that's happening in one of the classes, there are so many, you know, advanced students around here, and they have discussion groups, and there's people that you can talk to and ask, and I guarantee you, you're probably not the only one asking the question. You may be the only one asking it out loud. But you can come to pretty much any of the classes. People, and again, I'm going to get ahead of myself. We'll do this at the end. Otherwise, I'm not going to have the time to. We'll talk next steps. Remind me. Because I know you all have questions about the Lamrim class, too. Okay, we're doing okay. So what we're going to talk about tonight is the third principal aspect of the path, the second wing of enlightenment, the deep, deep subject, the wisdom of emptiness. And many people describe this as a difficult topic, and like any other thing that we discuss, it's not going to be easy to understand. It's very interesting. Don't expect to leave this class and understand emptiness, okay? What I'm hoping to do is peel back a couple of layers of that onion and get you even just a few things to be able to at least have a little bit of a aha, oh, like I said, this is something that people study their entire lives. So I'm into visual aids. Y'all know me. This is my emptiness bucket. So we have a few rules. Okay. A few rules. I'm going to put some of these things in here. Let's put this in here. Okay. My emptiness bucket, right? I've got things in this bucket, right? I'm going to take my cell phone out. Is the bucket empty? There's still stuff in the bucket, right? Could I say, in a weird English way, could I say that this bucket is empty of phone?
Yeah.
Oh, keep that. Keep that thought. This bucket is empty of phone, but it's not empty. Emptiness is not nothingness. We are not talking nihilism. So just kind of hang on to that thought. This is one of my first Sandy rules, because we'll all go down that path right off the bat. Okay, you throw the baby out with the bathwater. So anytime somebody starts going down this path, remember Sandy's bucket. Okay, this is just to prove a point. Emptiness does not mean nothingness. The way we talk about it is going to be weird, because we could say the bucket was empty of phone, but there's still stuff in the bucket. Okay, there's number one. All right. Emptiness, shunyata is the Sanskrit term, is the absence or lack of true existence. Ultimately, every phenomenon is empty of existing truly or from its own side or independently. We're going to come at this a million different ways tonight, and we're going to go through definitions, and we're going to talk about it, and we're going to discuss it, and again, you don't expect to totally get this, but it just have a little bit of a ground because you're going to hear these terms. True or inherent existence is also described as intrinsic reality, concrete, independent, existing, or existing from its own side. You're going to be listening to from its own side. So we're going to kind of clarify some of those things. This is a quality that we instinctively project on ourselves and everything we experience. This is the belief that things exist from their own side. Independence of parts, causes, and conditions, or your own mind experiencing them. Through Buddhist teachings and practice, we seek to overcome this false belief and to ultimately develop the ability to see things as they actually exist. Remember those six things that we said were the cause of suffering, and that last one was wrong view. And we kind of bounced around that a little bit because there's a lot of different layers of meaning. The fact that we don't view things as they really exist. We don't view things as they really exist. That's one of the base lines of the meaning of that. We actually don't see things as they really exist. Okay, so Venerable Amy, where's my book? So this Buddhism in a nutshell, I'm going to read one little paragraph from her here. What does the term emptiness mean? According to Tibetan Buddhism, emptiness refers to an absence of inherent existence. What is inherent existence? Inherent existence is a quality we instinctively project onto ourselves and everything we experience. We see things as solidly, concretely existing from their own side, in and of themselves, by way of their own nature, independent of causes and conditions, parts, or our own mind experiencing them. What is this? Tell me when it stops being a flower. Just call it out anytime you think we're done. Anytime you think it's not a flower. Is it still a flower?
No.
To some people it would be. What is this? Part of a flower, right? Parts, pieces and parts. Okay. So the causes and conditions that cause this flower to grow. Somebody explain that to me. Where's the mic?
A seed.
Okay. A seed. What has to happen for a flower to grow? Call it out. Yell it out.
Water.
Germinated. Water. Sunshine. Okay. Causes and conditions. Causes and conditions. All of these things have to happen or that seed's never going to grow. That flower will not be, correct? Causes and conditions. The second this flower comes into existence, it's really impermanent and it's already going out of existence. Everything is like that. Okay? So, like I said, this is the fun stuff to me. Okay? You can think of it as karma is how things operate and emptiness is how things really exist. Again, I'm going to come at this 52 different ways. We'll come back to the flower and go around. The guy that I took Buddhism in a nutshell from many, many years ago said, use this as an example. Suppose I say the word ibu. Ibu. Does that mean anything to anybody? Not a thing, right? What if I told you that that word means mother? It's Indonesian for mother. So now when I say that, most of you will get, you know, think when I say the word ibu, now you're thinking of an Indonesian woman with a little baby, right? But before I told you that, it meant nothing to you. So it was just a label. It meant nothing to you. This is flower to us in English. In Czech, it's kivet. In Danish, it's blomst. In Finnish, it's kuka. And in Turkish, it's çiçek. Okay? Those are all the labels we humans have given this, right? Labels. That's a label we've given it. We've decided to label this so we can communicate and we can talk about it. We can identify it. But Americans have labeled it. English have labeled it this thing. Danish have labeled it this thing. If they start talking over there about blomst, you don't know what they're talking about. Okay, these are just labels. What is this to an ant?
It's a giant tower.
It's a giant tower. What is it to a bee? Maybe food. Okay. If this flower existed independently from its own side, it would always be the exact same thing to every sentient mind. Say it again. If this flower existed from its own side, independent from its causes and conditions, its pieces and parts, and labeling minds, if it was a permanent, independent thing, it would be the exact same thing for every sentient mind that saw it. Think about that. Woo, deep end. Say it out loud, Brian.
I mean,
this is where we start getting into the conversation. This is the cool stuff.
Speaking of the conventional reality and
yes.
The ultimate reality. So that's if everybody, you know, the convention in English is to call it a flower. The convention in different languages is to call it something different. It's still obviously the atoms or the energy that make up that object are of course the same.
Right.
But and I mean, this is just one way to look at it, but it becomes more of a personal thing when you say, like, are you good or are you not good? You know, then you can say, oh, you know, that's still your label on that. Just like you've labeled that flower, you know, flower, and somebody else could label it differently. Every single thought in your head is the same way. It's still your convention of how you label that.
Right.
But is it that way ultimately? No. It does not exist in the sense of that. You know, it doesn't exist independent of causes and conditions. Every thought in your head is dependent on causes and conditions. Your perception of things are dependent on causes and conditions.
Okay, so everybody somewhat following that?
I mean, it's hard to explain.
Go ahead.
Reminds me of something that I heard years ago, is when you label something, you limit it. It's a flower, but it's also a ring. It could be something to put around as a bow. It's not just the flower. When you name it, you limit it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's also, think about the issues that we have with labels, okay? You look like you want to say more.
I mean, I was just thinking about the label thing. Considering this is a child, that we don't have any proof that we actually see colors the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say blue, I think of blue.
Correct.
But what I'm looking at blue, maybe your eyes see what I call
correct.
Red. But it doesn't matter. We will never know it because when I say blue, you see that. When I describe it, I say, oh, it's a very cool color. Well, you've been hearing cool color described with that thing. So we'll talk about it back and forth, and we're seeing two totally different things. But we're still seeing the same piece of cloth, and it's just our own interpretation of it. Mm-hmm. Nothing has changed the cloth. Nothing has changed the physics that bounced the wavelengths of light off to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's only our own perception of it.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That is correct.
Correct. Okay.
So
yeah.
Think about the implications of that.
Yeah, take that further. So he's got a. Do you have an add-on to this, or
a
separate?
And the point there, just that, you know, yeah, we did have very different perceptions, but in the end, it didn't matter because we didn't know we had the different perceptions. We still keep
right.
talking about the same thing.
But now take it into subjects. So this is where I'm not going to go down this path too far. But this is where he's talking about a very easy subject. He's talking about color and a blue cloth. But think about it when it comes to much deeper subjects. Think about that. Those hard things that happen, or the fact that, you know, your boss just blew up at you at work today, you know, and so it's trying to kind of separate out from some of this is where you start to think about the emptiness of things and the fact that your ego gets in the way there. Okay, so it's trying to decipher some of these parts. So now I'm going to back up just a little bit because we just went right in. Dependence arising. Things exist, but they exist in dependence on their parts, causes, and conditions, and a labeling mind. So that's called dependent arising. You're going to come into that term a lot. We talk about dependent arising. There is nothing. Somebody give me an example of something that you think exists from its own side, that is permanent. Can anybody, let's have a discussion. Anybody in here have something that they think is actually permanent that does exist from its own side?
Permanent and unchanging?
Yep. That exists from its own side.
How about your permanence itself?
It's a concept.
It's not a thing.
That's not a thing. It's a concept.
Object?
Things
that exist independently or from their own side. Universe has parts. Universe has, depending on the different scientific thoughts, Buddha nature. So you went deep right off the bat. So we're not going to go there. It's a goodie, though. Okay. I would.
It's degrading. It's always degrading. It's always changing.
Yeah.
Energy, it's always changing. I mean, the very definition of energy is matter changing.
So when we think about it, even us, okay? So you guys are phenomenal because most of the time I get all this, you know, concrete and rocks and all that kind of stuff, which is easy to discuss. But you guys already went there. All right, so now think about it as even, let's go through Sandy, okay? I do not exist the way I think I do. And you all can work on this. I'm just going to talk to you from myself, okay? So all the pieces and parts that make up Sandy, I've got the body, fingers and toes and blonde hair and or brown hair. And it used to be blonde. I did when I was a child. So all these pieces and parts. And then you keep trying to go down into this, well, where is Sandy? What is Sandy? Okay? And these are those deep meditations that you can do to try to find that I, and you really can't. But that's where we get stuck on so many things because so much of our suffering comes from that belief in the I. Okay? So much of our suffering in life, whether it's our ego, our pride, our hurt, you know, it all comes from that perception of the I. And so this is one of the deepest parts of our study that we try to do, and we try to look at that. Okay? Do I exist? If I stepped out in front of a truck, would I die? Yes! Okay? So this is, we're really talking the difference between conventional, again, the bucket is not empty, okay, but the way that I think I exist, the way that I think I exist is not the reality. This is that wisdom of emptiness, okay? This is that taking the layers of the onion off. This is, again, you are not going to get this in the 20 minutes that we're going to discuss this in class. It's just starting to at least understand some of these terms and at least start to maybe get a hint of it. Okay? And so it is that just layer of the way that Sandy is. And then when we start to talk about the labels, think about how in some ways wonderful labels are because it allows us to communicate with each other. If we didn't have labels, we couldn't talk to each other. Okay? So it's a conventional form of communication. But think about what trouble we get into with some of these labels, okay, and how hurtful some of them can be. And I guarantee you, if I gave each of you a piece of paper and I told you to write down 10 things that described me, there would be a lot of differences, right? Well, that there's a lot of emptiness there because if I was this permanent thing, I would look the same, sound the same, be the same to everybody. Right? But the fact that you all will see me and perceive me different is actually from your side. Okay? Whether you had a, you know, an old girlfriend that I reminded you of and boy, that was not a good thing, you know? Or I reminded you of your sister and that is a good thing. So the things that you bring to the table will give you that perception of me. Okay? Does that kind of make sense a little bit? So you can kind of see where some of that would come from. Yes.
So, and I've forgotten a good portion of what you said, the definition, what you were saying before as I'm trying to think about this. So then, if a thing is permanent, then that means that it exists separate from any perception of it?
Nope. So we're talking about...
I'd like to.
Causes and conditions. Parts. I kicked my bucket. I know, it's still not empty. Where am I going, Chris? Wait, I'm not listening to you. Parts, causes, and conditions. That's what it is. Parts. Causes and conditions, and labeling mind. I know, yay, I could spell. This is called dependent arising. Dependent or dent? I spell too. Dependent arising. Everything is dependent on its parts, causes and conditions, and a labeling mind. Everything. Everything. And this is what gets us a little bit into trouble because we're working on things existing from their own side. And why? So why is this concept so empowering? Why is this? Why are we working on this? What does this mean, and why is this so empowering? Go for it.
Oh, no, it's all about attachment. I mean, it's all about the lack of logic in being attached to things that aren't permanent and don't exist the way you think they do.
The cause of suffering. It's the cause of suffering. There's more. What does that mean? Because it can change. It's all about attachment. It's all about things. We think that these things are permanent. We think our relationships are permanent. We think our life is permanent. We think our health is permanent. And then we get upset when we get sick and have to go there. We get upset when these bad things happen to us. We get upset when we lose our job. We get upset when the car gets in an accident. We get upset when we get chocolate cake instead of carrot cake. Okay? But we have the ability, this means we have the ability to change our minds. Yes?
I was just going to ask, where would the attachment come from? Like, where does it come from? Like, why do we just learn it? You know, how does that come about?
So we have, we talked about attachment and what that actually means in one of our previous classes. Attachment, the actual terminology again, let's describe it. A disturbing thought that exaggerates the positive qualities of an object and wishes to possess it. And it's one of the root of six delusions. Okay, so we use attachment in our Western world as a good word. Okay, I'm attached to this. I'm very attached to my family. We use it as a kind of a more of a positive word, right? In Buddhism, we're talking about that attachment that says that there's the I is here. Okay, this is the I. I'm in love with Chris because Chris is good to me. He takes care of me. He takes care of all of the things that happen here at the class, and so he's my friend, and I'll do it. And then Chris doesn't come one night, and now I'm at him. Okay, so it's all about me. Okay, so I'm attached to some of these things because it's about me. It's not about Chris. Okay, so that attachment has the I, and attachment always has the I. Okay, and that's like that movie where everything's, I'm the center of everything. Okay, the I, and the I doesn't exist. I know. Woo!
Is the goal just to eliminate yourself, knowing that we're just one among the whole thing, we're not separate from everything?
No, the goal is to achieve what I would call Buddha nature, to have that loving compassion to get rid of all of the suffering that we talked about, the six root delusions, all of the anger, all of the negative things that we have. If we could get rid of all of the negative, just imagine a world like this where people were not angry. You know, people helped one another. People had compassion for one another. You know, people were not jealous. We were, you know, happy for other people, where we really tried to help. So think about just living in a, just think about shutting that door and everybody just in this room was enlightened, and or at least most of the way. If everybody in this room just had so much less suffering than we do. Okay? Now, if every single one of us could achieve a fraction of that, right? And then you go out there and then you have that little ripple effect. Because you know, you don't have any clue how much even a smile can mean to somebody else. Okay, so this is some of that karmic ripple type of stuff that you can do. Because it does make a difference. But this is all about if we could each, there isn't a collective conscious. We're not in that way. But if we all could achieve that, and if we all, at that point, had the Mahayana bodhicitta, then we'd go and we'd want everybody else, so we'd be helping everybody else. You just imagine, now I've got John Lennon in my mind, you know. Everything's a song to me, so I've been on Christopher Robin all night, and now it's John Lennon. But you can, I know, it works. But, so it all kind of goes back, again, to that little video, that this is life. We're living in this. And it's trying, how do we get the opportunity, we have the opportunity every moment of every day to choose. And we get so caught up in everyday busy bustle. We still have to live our lives. We still have to go to work. but how. We have the choice of how we deal with things. It's not easy. I wish it was as easy as I make it sound, because, man, I'd be, you know, I'd be a Buddha, and I'm not. So it's that opportunity to learn every day. There are little practices. So there's some of these little things. I always tell you all these little things that I do, just like the red light and, you know, and just like they said in the movie. And you try to do this without sarcasm, okay? Try to do it without sarcasm. When you get there to, like, the stop sign or something and you're in that hurry, remember I told you, so I'd use the lights for doing prayers. For a while there, I used to do it where, oh, good, you get to go. Yeah, I'm so happy for you, you know? And then I'm sure maybe you're going to the hospital. I would make up stories. I would make up stories that would help me, just like he did in that video, to try to help me. Now, I will admit to sarcasm being there for a while, okay? But it did get better. And somebody that was speeding by me on there, instead of that flush of anger that we tend to feel, ooh, you know, stupid or whatever, it's like maybe they're going to the hospital. Maybe they got a call that the kids at school hurt. Do whatever you need to do to change your mind and make it more positive, okay? So just do your little stories. And again, try to do it without the sarcasm, but even if it has to be there for a little bit, it at least it's an awareness. At least the seed is planted, because I hear Sandy's voice right now. But it's the attempt to change your mind. And again, if we can't do it on the little things, how are we ever going to do it on the big things? That is kind of working a little bit. Dependent arising. Impermanence. They go hand in hand. Because the second something comes into being, it's already going out. Our lives, we're born and we spend our entire lives dying, right? Okay, the flower. It's born and then it wilts and dies. Somebody picks it. So everything, atoms, anything. Rocks are formed by water and sand. And then they go back. I mean, everything, right? Stars. So everything is impermanent. Everything is impermanent. So, and again, this isn't a sad thing. It's an empowering thing if you look at it that way. Makes sense? And I feel like everybody's just like in shock. Kind of makes sense a little bit.
My mom cried when... How'd that go? Never mind.
So, mental mind moments, that's part of that ever-changing, okay? And our minds ever-changing. And that ability to change the mind once we can recognize, and remember we said that mental awareness was part of the definition of the mind. And so that's what gives us this ability to work with our minds and change our minds. So again, we're that mechanic running down the freeway and working on our mind. And you can think about it from this conventional base that we kind of put this wrapper over things, you know, the way that we see things, but we don't see how that thing really exists. Okay? Any other questions? Any questions on this, or is this just mind blown? Yes?
I guess what you mean by really exists.
What do you mean by really exists?
That's the way we tend to talk. That's the way we tend to think. There is nothing that exists from its own side. Yeah. Kind of makes sense. Yeah. Like I said, sometimes people will just come up with amazing ideas. I want to take some time to do an analytical meditation. But first I'll open it up. I'll open this wide open. Any questions at all about whether anything that we've talked about the last 20 minutes, anything we've talked about the last five, you know, sessions, or anything just in general? Yes. We've got a couple of them. Chris, any of the mic? We've got two. I'm wide open.
There's one thing that I looked at right when I got in here. I was looking at the Four Noble Truths because she was trying to ask the Google Home the other day what the Four Noble Truths was when she was doing meditation.
What did it say?
I am curious about, is that renunciation?
Yes.
What is that?
Okay, so renunciation, this is something we went through in previous class, but that's not scold. So renunciation is, I'm always going to go to the exact. It's better for me if I give you the exact definition and then I can give you mine. So it's renouncing your attachments to things. It doesn't mean you have to give up all of the stuff. Okay, everybody kind of tends to go down, you know, again, throw the baby out with the bathwater. It doesn't mean I have to go give up all of my things. I don't have to give everything up and go live in a cave. Although some people can do that, and it works for them. It means I give up my attachment to things. So I renounce my attachment to all of this stuff. That is not out there is what is going to, where I'm going to find enlightenment, where I'm going to find my happiness. It is not out there. So you know what? I can have it, but I can give it up. I just renounce my attachment to things. Okay? Doesn't mean I have to give everything up and not have any fun. Okay? In all honesty, the Tibetan Buddhist monks that I know have the most joy of any people I've ever met. And I want what they have. Okay? This is an incredibly joyful practice. It's totally different than, you know, you see suffering, suffering, suffering up there. And that makes everybody think that Buddhism is all, you know, depressing. And it's exactly the opposite. Okay, you have a question? Nothing exists from its own side. Nothing exists from its own side. Again, where's my emptiness bucket? Things are not. We're not talking nihilism. Things exist conventionally, okay, but nothing exists from its own side. So conventionally, these things exist. Okay, you go and walk in front of a truck, boom, you are, you know, it's not good. All right, so don't think that truck isn't there. But we don't see things as they truly exist. So we're talking about we don't see things as they truly exist. They don't exist from their own side. Yes. Because, okay, so things exist, but they do not exist independently. So it's how they exist might be another way to talk about it. Things exist, but we don't see them as they truly exist. Things, nothing exists from its own side. And we see things, we tend to see things that exist as a permanent existence independent of anything else. Yes?
So, one way that we experiment is looking at that wooden table that you're using.
Yep.
Conventionally, we look at that and we see table, we've got that label. But the way that exists is there was a tree, there was an acorn, there was a forester, cut the tree down, there was a lumber mill, there was a carpenter, carpenter had parents. If any of those things were eliminated, that table wouldn't exist. But when we look at that table, we don't see all those things. We don't see all those causes that brought that shape into existence. One way to think of that table is it's tabley wood. Mm. It's wood in the form that we label table. That's how it exists. But when we look at it conventionally, we just see table, and it's permanent.
Yep.
It exists on its own, and it has its own attributes, we think. And the truth of it is our labeling mind has projected properties on that thing that don't exist.
What other non-properties does that table have that do exist? It is flat, which the tree was not.
Well, that's the that's where you get into philosophy.
Okay. I was going to mention the going back to the video of the traffic. So, yeah, somebody cuts you off,
and you may be thinking, suing, see, going, that guy is a jerk. He is a jerk. That's in your head.
Oh, right.
But he's just a guy, and then they're saying, like, all these conditions, and maybe he's going to the hospital, and he's
sure.
So
that table is flat.
Exactly. Like, if everybody in the world looked at that table, and they knew, and you said it in their language, of flat, yes, they would all see it as flat.
Right.
Because it is flat.
Right. So I was going to say, if you said that table has properties, that it's the tree, that the acorn, that all these other things were before it,
right.
Because I can trace everything back to eventually I get to a star that went supernova and created elephants, right?
Yep.
So that's everything in existence.
Well, for all that
mass. Everything
yeah.
mass.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So then that definitely goes to the point of that everything is based on parts, cause and conditions.
Right.
That handles all that, like everything was a star, right?
Right. But there were definitely causes and conditions that made that flat, the song. So.
Exactly. But and then the labeling mind says table.
Right.
Yeah. It's not a table. Yeah. So any sentient, labeling mind, again, remember we're talking sentient minds here.
Well, why is it not a table to an ant? All right, they don't call it a table either. They don't even have a word that I can say. That doesn't mean they're still seeing.
To them, it's an obstacle.
Okay, but it's the thing, that's just a label. They call that an obstacle of a particular type. I call it a table. Still the same thing. Right?
Based upon the use of physical, right? Like the average.
So all of these, so you guys are all talking pieces and parts and conditions.
Yeah, that's true.
You know.
Yep.
And like an ant might see it as
yep.
a possible place for a home. Or
yep.
Like,
but
nonetheless, they're still all looking at the same thing. They're all applying their own label to it.
Because it does exist ultimately.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Right.
Definitely.
So I guess then the thing I was wondering is we're saying we don't see it as it does exist.
And another good thing to know is this practice is not about.
Speak into the mic because I want to make sure that.
This is not about. This is from Mental Center. It's not about explaining the universe.
Yeah.
This is about reducing government. That's you got to keep that in mind. That was from her. So it's kind of like, you know, knowing what the ant thought, or whatever, you know, it's not really the point. It's like the idea of, like, you can bring it to your life by saying, is that guy, he's a jerk. And are they really that? You know, it's like based on your current perception of the environment, that's where you think that. And that's causing your suffering, to think negatively about. So the idea of all of this is to reduce that suffering in your mind. By thinking of it,
Would this be accurate to say when we say the part about you see it not really as it exists, I mean, are you referring to the not seeing the impermanence factor?
That's one of them, definitely. Yeah, that we don't see things as they really exist, that we do think that things are permanent. So we don't see things as impermanent.
Okay,
so
thank you. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and these are, like I said, this is just the tip. Did you want to say one more thing?
Well, I was going to go a little bit further with Bron's example. So you're in the car, you're on the downline going to lunch, you've got your music playing, your tea, and this car pulls out in front of you and cuts you off, and your shield of anger is replaced with joy seeing this friend, and you pull up beside the car and you're in the field. You projected these attributes onto this car and when you stop, that doesn't exist at all. You pull up beside them, and you see it's your mom, and you say, now the anger is replaced with compassion. So this anger is now filled with compassion because it's your mom. Whose car is she driving? Where is she going? She's in a hurry. She wasn't paying attention. I almost run her over. And so on. So instantly, your whole view of that situation changed. Your view. The situation has changed. But your view of it.
Sure. Absolutely.
So that is like the perfect segue into this meditation. And so phenomenally, I could not have planned that better. We are going to segue. It is, we've only got 15 minutes left. We're going to segue into this analytical meditation. So for those of you that are new, we've been talking about the two different forms of meditation from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective. One is concentration meditation, the other is analytical meditation. We've been practicing several concentration meditations, especially using the breath, because the breath is neutral and it's always with you. And so using the breath and using concentration meditation is just like we're going to the gym to work out in order to go run the Boston Marathon, in order to go do these events. So one is about strengthening the mind, and one is about actually working with the mind. Okay, so we're going to do an analytical meditation, and this is called equanimity. And I'd like to do it, and then I'd like to talk about it for a couple of minutes. Just because before I tell you how I do it, I want you to try it so that I don't put things in your head ahead of time. Okay? This is called equanimity. 39. Let me make sure I've got... I literally was ripping this book apart earlier today because I've done too many of these. Okay, so get yourself in a comfortable position. Those of you that know it, start to go through that seven-point meditation posture. Get your the center and get your mind focused for the day. And be present, be here. We've had a very lively discussion, and this is hopefully the first of many for you. But just start doing some of the breathing meditations, whether it's the counting the breaths or their attention that you've been working on here. And focus your attention on your breath. Let's set a motivation and sit comfortably and generate the strong intention to do this meditation in order to overcome the self-centered bias and judgments and to develop the mind of perfect equanimity and balance toward others. Imagine in the space in front of you three people. Someone you like, someone you dislike, and someone you feel indifferent towards. So find three people. Someone you like, someone you dislike, and someone you feel indifferent toward. And keep these three images in your mind throughout this meditation. First, focus on your friend. Allow your feelings for that person to arise strongly. Feel your conviction that this person is definitely and truly a friend. That is a person who is good to you, fulfills your needs and wishes. Also, how you really want this person to be happy, and identify yourself with these really good feelings. Now shift your attention to your enemy, this person you dislike, who's not kind to you, who does not satisfy your needs, who annoys you and makes you angry, who's hurt you. Regard this person carefully. And look carefully at your feelings that you have about this person. Now shift your attention to this so-called stranger, this person that you just barely know, but whom you don't dislike or like. And look carefully at that person and note your feelings of maybe indifference. Now consider and recognize that the nature of your relationships with each of these three people and the labels that you have put on each of them are based solely on what they do or don't do for you at this point in time. Think of people who have been your friend and then became your enemy. Or maybe people that you didn't like when you got to know them better, maybe they became your friends. Or strangers who became friends or enemies. Each of these labels is temporary and impermanent. It's just what the situation is at the current time. Now move your attention back to your friend and imagine a situation that might cause that friendship to end. Imagine your friend turning against you. Experience the resentment, anger, and hurt that you would feel in such a situation. Do you still feel warm, friendly feelings toward that person? Do you still wish him or her well? Do you want that person to be happy? Where is your friend now? And remember, this person wasn't your friend before you were acquainted. Recognize how easily this person could cease to be your friend now, just as you have imagined. Think to yourself that there is no sound reason for feeling kind and loving toward only the friend of this moment. Relationships have changed in the past and will continue to change. Today's friend can become tomorrow's enemy, and vice versa. Now move your attention to the present enemy, this person that you don't like. Imagine a situation in which you could be drawn together and come close, a common interest, a word of praise or kindness. Look at that person and your feelings toward them carefully. Are your feelings softening, becoming a little warmer? You can learn to feel warmly toward your enemies. This has happened before and will happen again. So why do we hold so strongly to this concept that this person is definitely enemy? I don't like them. Now move your attention to the stranger and imagine how one act of kindness or anger from this person could immediately turn him or her into a friend or enemy. There is no inherent, definite stranger there. There is no sound reason for the feelings of indifference that we hold on to. Remember that your present friend and your present enemy were both strangers to you beforehand, and this enemy could become a friend or an enemy now. Maintain your awareness of these three people in front of you and think about the fragile impermanence of these relationships. And it is only your misconceived belief in the concreteness of these labels of friend, enemy, and stranger that holds your mind back from the possibility of change and fluidity. Your friend, enemy, and stranger all want happiness just as much as you do. In this respect, we're all equal. Also, everyone is equal in having the potential to develop their minds to the fullest extent and to achieve ultimate clarity and compassion. The differences that we see in people are superficial, based only on our own mistaken and narrow self-centered views. In fact, everyone is equal in deserving our care and compassion. None of this means that we should not discriminate at all. On a practical level, our ability to distinguish between actions and individuals is necessary. And naturally, we feel closer to some people and are wise to keep our distance from others. This is not in any way contradictory to this meditation. The point of the meditation is to develop equal concern, equal regard for everyone, for their well-being, whether they help or harm us at this point in time, and to see that the labels that we put on others are often arbitrary, mistaken, and very changeable. Bring your attention back to the room, and let's set a dedication that we meditated here today in order to be of benefit to all beings, to learn just a little bit more about ourselves and others. And we spent the time here at Kadampa Center for this last 5 weeks. Let's do a dedication for the entire class. We spent a lot of time, and you did a lot of effort to make sure that you came every week for 5 weeks. That was a lot of commitment to do, and coming to a Buddhist center for the first time can be a huge step for people. And for whatever reason that brought you, let's dedicate the efforts that we all made to become a little bit happier, and that this ripples out to be a benefit to all. Okay, bring your attention back. So we don't have a lot of time, but I'm going to give you two things. Number one, I'll give you the rundown. I use this meditation all the time. I have seen immense results from this. I will give you one specific. Okay, I work in communications and marketing, and there was a vendor that I just didn't like. And I'd been working with him on and off for years with different clients and stuff, and it was always, oh, who are you working with? And it was always a problem. And it was one of those where I'd see that phone and that caller ID and And one time I did this meditation before I had to call him. And so I picture that white screen, so it's all blank, and I use my husband because I love him, and that's an easy one for me to like, okay, and put all that emotion stuff there. I've got the lady at the post office. I can recognize her, don't know her. Seems nice, but she's a stranger. I just can recognize her face. And then this vendor. And I did this exact meditation before I had to call him. Okay? So like 10 minutes before I called him, I did this. And I actually took it even deeper, where you start to think about, because there's a deeper way to do this meditation, where you really start to, again, make up some of those stories. He has a life. He has a family. He's trying to do the best that he can do. So I just kind of went with this entire thing. So when I called him, I can't change him. I can change me. So when I called him, I'm pretty sure my tone was different. And we actually had a good conversation. We got through it. And for the next few weeks, I tried to do this every time. And I will tell you, but by the end of about 2 months, he was one of my favorite vendors. And it was an amazing experience just from this. I can't change him. I can't change anybody else. I can change me. And just by me changing my tone, it was literally all me. Okay? He changed his, and we developed a very good working relationship. But I took the first step to do something about it. I can't work with him. I can't change his mind. I can change mine. So I actually still to this day will do this. I do all these meditations. So that I'm just giving you real life experiences where some of these things can help. Okay, let's briefly go through what is next. Definitely check the calendar. You can sign up. This usually lives on the table out there, so you can sign up to receive the emails, and that way you'd know what's going on at Kadampa Center, what classes and things. There's a holiday party coming up December 15th at Kadampa Center. Everybody is invited. There are, I think we talked briefly about Wednesday nights, is the Lam Rim class. So we talked about the Lam Rim being this entire Buddhist scope of study. Geshe Gelug Choda is back from his travels. He will be teaching tomorrow night on the Lam Rim. You are all welcome to come. Some of it may feel like the deep end of the pool. I'm not sure quite where he's going to start. But he tends to like do very basics, but he's phenomenal. If you're interested at all, you are welcome to go to that class. It starts at 8 and is over at 9:30. And anytime Geshe-la teaches, you know, I usually try to go. I have to shoot tomorrow night, so I won't be able to be there. But he's a phenomenal teacher. And I think he might even be teaching on the foundation of all good qualities. I'm not really sure. Something in the Lam Rim he will be teaching on. So you're all welcome to go. And it's not something that, you know, some of it you'll understand because we've talked about it in class a little bit. You'll get even deeper understandings of it. Some of it may be the deep end of the pool. Put it up in your mind bookcase and then go ask somebody about it, and it will come. Sunday teachings. This coming Sunday is the anniversary of His Holiness being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. We're going to have a little bit of a special ceremony this Sunday, but usually Sundays are open to everybody. They're just about happiness. We'll have discussion things. Geshe Gelug is back, and he's teaching now. A couple of you, I think, came this past Sunday. So you don't have to be Buddhist. We've got people of all ages, all you know, levels. I don't care if you're Christian, Jewish. I don't care if you're atheist. I don't care what you are. You're welcome to come to any and all of it. We're not about proselytizing. So Sundays are a good place to go. The next DB module is Samsara and Nirvana. And that's a very good class. Stephanie Smith is teaching that. She's phenomenal. That starts January 8th. So we're going into a little bit of the holidays. So there's not going to be a whole lot. Just check. We'll probably have a lot of events, but not a lot of classes going on. So the next DB module is Samsara and Nirvana, starting on Monday, January 8th with Stephanie Smith. Meditation 101, Tuesday, January 9th. It's going to be Meditation 101. That's the flip side of this class. That's the other introductory class. So a lot of the meditations that we did in just minutes, they'll be going into a much more depth. I'm not quite sure who's leading that class, but that's the other one. That one starts January 9th. Jill is teaching it. Okay, Meditation 101. Saturday, January 6th, the first Saturday of every month, they have what they call First Saturday Meditation. And so that's kind of a longer meditation class. I think there's different teachers that might lead that class. Then we also have different spiritual practice, pujas. If you check in the calendar, pujas, Tara practice, you'll see different things. A puja is a prayer gathering. So you can think of a puja like, you know, that whisk broom. If you take it apart and only have one or two strands and try to clean the floor, you're not going to get very far. But if you take it, a whole bunch of them, put them together, you have a broom and you can sweep the dirt up. So a puja is kind of considered a prayer gathering where you take many voices in one prayer. And so these are more spiritual, very much Tibetan Buddhist. Many of them are done in a mix of Tibetan as well as English. So they're interesting. It depends on where you're at. I like them. I enjoy them. The first couple of times I went just for, you know, I'm going to admit. Okay, so I went, and you get this big book, and you're looking at it, and you hear, they're starting the prayers, and I'm reading along the prayers, and pretty soon I'm looking at, like, how many more pages are we doing? I'm just being honest. I'm going to tell you exactly. And it's like, real, so it's like, okay. And I when I try something new, I will try it a few times before I judge it. I'll try to be honest with myself. And I will say by about the third or fourth time, when I'd heard it enough that I actually was listening to what they were saying, then all of a sudden it made a difference to me. And then all of a sudden now it means something to me. First couple of times it was not so good for me. But I just stayed with it. So the holiday party I've told you about, there's little pink slips out there. And you can find more out on the cover, some of the events that are going on. You can find information at the website. And then I'm going to make one quick generosity announcement. Everything that we do here at Kadampa Center is done for free. We don't charge anybody to come. If you find any benefit here, if you can give anything at all, there's little donation boxes at the outside. It helps us to keep the lights on. 99% of the people that work here do it as volunteers. You know, we've got Jill Marie is our paid center manager, and Amanda's our paid office staff, and that's basically it. You know, we take care of our sangha, and everybody else that works here as volunteers. So any help that you can give, you're going to see a lot of the annual appeal announcements and a lot of the generosity announcements, so you'll be seeing a lot of that stuff. And so it's just whatever you can, and if you're so inclined to, do it. Buddhism has, of course, definitions for everything. Generosity from a Buddhist perspective is being able to give without regret. Okay? So you never give so much that you regret it, that it puts you into an unwise. You always do everything with wisdom. But it is about giving from your heart, but paying attention to it. So as with anything, there's definitions, and like I said, especially Tibetan Buddhism. And I'm going to stop because I really appreciate y'all spending your time. Thank you so much. If you have any questions, some of you have been contacting me, and I appreciate that. I like that. If you have any questions, I always call myself Vanna White. I don't know all the answers, but I know who does. And I can point you into the right direction. And so I hope that this was of some benefit to you with whatever you choose to do with it. Thank you, thank you, thank you for coming.